Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Military History, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Jeffrey Bristol, and I am a host on the channel. Today we have with us Bing West, who has a long military history himself, having served in the Marines during Vietnam as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, and has written many books about military subjects, both fiction and nonfiction, including co-authoring General Mattis's memoirs. His latest book is a work of fiction, The Last Platoon, wherein he describes a short, the whole novel takes place in 7 days, but a very bloody mission in a rural district in Afghanistan. Welcome to the channel, Mr. West. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Thanks, Jeff. And I go by Bing. Bing.
All like right.
Bing Crosby. Yeah.
All right. Great, Bing. It's the formalities out of the way. I'd love if you could talk to us a little bit about yourself and your background. I've given a very short introduction, but I think it's best to hear from the man himself. So just please introduce yourself to readers who listeners who might not be familiar with you.
Sure. Well, I was born in Boston when World War II was going on, and two of my uncles were fighting in the Marines in the Pacific. And whenever they would come home, they would be my babysitters. So my mother said I was destined to become a Marine. And after college, I was supposed to go to law school, but instead I joined the Marines infantry, fought in Vietnam, then went back to do my graduate work after that. But I kept going back to Vietnam for several years, and I wrote two or three books about my experiences war fighting, one of them being called The Village, where I was with a small group, what we called a combined action platoon. There were 12 Marines, and we were in a village 485 days. that was really something. And then later, I was an assistant secretary of defense under President Reagan. I thought he was just a wonderful man. And I got a chance to see pretty much the world then. And then I went back as a writer for the Iraq War. And then I decided to do the Afghanistan War. So I made about 20, 30, 40 trips and embedded with the platoons from one end of Iraq to the other and from one end of Afghanistan to the other. And out of that, I wrote a series of books. So altogether, I've written about a dozen books about war, battlefields, and what happens in the differences between how a White House looks at things and how it looks like when you're on the ground doing the fighting.
Yeah, and that's one of the interesting things about this book is that there is an interesting track back between the DC side of things and on the ground. So, you know, that's a really interesting and varied background. And one of the things I was thinking about in terms of your writing, one, what's it like to go from the battlefield to writing about the battlefield? You know, obviously you bring a lot of experience to it, but how is it processing those memories and how is it going back to Afghanistan and Iraq and not being a Marine yourself, but being somebody who's going alongside of them?
Well, I'll answer the second one, then the first. The Commandant of the Marine Corps says that he cannot recall you after you're 95 years of age. So up until then, you're still considered to be capable of fighting. So whenever I went back, the Marines just treated me as, you know, okay, well, he's been there, he's done that. I generally refused to carry a weapon because I had to keep up with them, and I didn't want to be carrying extra gear. And I used to tell them when they'd say, "Hey, come on, sir, you got to be carrying something." I'd say, "When you need me to be shooting, there will be plenty of weapons available." And so I found it very easy to move from one platoon to the other, which, Jeff, I couldn't have done. I was a platoon commander, infantry. I couldn't have done that if I were a pilot. A pilot today can't just, you know, get into a new F-35 and fly it. But the infantry hadn't changed that much. And that was, I was able to carry over when you're writing, and every writer will tell you this, the only thing that makes a writer is an iron ass. You just have to sit there every day with a blank piece of paper in front of you and work and work and work, and then rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until your wife is ready to shoot you. And at that particular point, you hope you finally have something worth saying. But there's no easy way about writing. None whatsoever.
It sounds a lot like being a lawyer.
Yeah, but you charge by the hour.
That's true. And it doesn't matter how good what I write is. many lawyers should be thankful for that. Some lawyers are great writers. You wonder why you're having to read this. But I think that's a great point. So, you know, taking it maybe the other direction for that same question, what's the relationship, do you think, between fiction and real life? You know, so obviously you bring a lot as a Marine infantry officer into your writing. But for people who, you know, are in boot camp or going through the basic school, you know, and obviously they have these thick reading lists and many of them are fiction. And I think fiction's very useful. What have you found? What do you think is the use for fiction for Marine soldiers, airmen, coasties, and sailors in training?
In this book, in this novel, for instance, The Last Platoon, it's really what happens on a battlefield. Every single of the firefight that's in that book was a real firefight that I was in. And so even in a novel, you begin, if you're reading carefully, to get a feel for what the culture is like, whether it's within a platoon in the infantry or on board a ship, you get a feeling for how it might be. And what General Jim Mattis is a good friend of mine, you know, he always says, if you don't read, I don't want you in my command.
Yeah. Well, and he was a famous one for books in his library.
Correct. Yeah. Jim and I used to exchange books all the time. We still do.
Yep.
There is no substitute for reading. No substitute whatsoever.
So what is it that, what do you think people get out of reading? Is it just knowing more about how far a rifle can fire, about the doctrine of the enemy? Is it character? What kinds of things do we get out of reading before we have these experiences?
Oh, I'd say the only genre that I deal with is military warfighting, close combat. And the two things I think you take away from my books and that kind of book, like The Last Platoon, is character. How much character counts? And the other thing, if you notice in my book, it seems like every firefight is almost choreographed on both sides. And it was, because Cruz, who's the protagonist, the major, the captain, Cruz knew he had Marines who hadn't been in combat before. So he kept saying, you have to do this, you have to do that. Because when you're out there in a firefight, it's two-sided and you're walking out into the unknown knowing that the Taliban who are out there, they're not out there to die. They're out there to kill you. So it's a mystery story. Who's going to win and who's going to outmaneuver the other person? Ground combat, when you're really close with the enemy within 500 meters, is like air-to-air combat between two quick jet fighters. You don't put your head up for more than 2 seconds at any given time, or it'll be whacked off on both sides. And so in the book, I try to show people what develops in a firefight and how Cruz was able to take his Marines and keep them moving because the Taliban were doing the same thing. So I would hope a reader would come away and say, oh, now I understand. Now I understand a lot more than I did before about what happens in that kind of a fight.
And over your career, you've obviously been in combat situations in at least three different countries, right? Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. How similar were those combat experiences between themselves?
All three of them were highly similar in the firefights. Vietnam was the most intense in a lot of ways because we had many better weapons in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we had night seeing devices in Afghanistan and Iraq that we did not have in Vietnam. What saved me a lot of times in Vietnam was that Americans can throw grenades farther than anyone else can throw a grenade. And that made a huge difference on the battlefields at night because we could outrange them by throwing the grenades farther. But the other thing about the experiences themselves, when you look back at them, they're very, very similar except for one thing. Death. The way in which death is now treated, Jeff, is vastly different than Vietnam. One night in Vietnam, we were in a fight during the day, and then it got dark, and we were being hit by mortars. And the next morning, the Marines came by me, some of the Marines, and they had in their ponchos two dead Marines. We didn't have stretchers back then. And I said, who are they? And they said, sir, it's Smithers and Sullivan or something. I said, who? And they said, oh, sir, they just joined us last night. I never even got a chance to meet them. And then they were dead in the morning. We put them on the helicopter when we're getting our resupplies, the bodies. And then we started out for the next fight, which occurred about 10 minutes later. So you accepted death because it was just after World War II. You accepted this was going to happen. It's quite different today. Everything stops. There's much more solemn. There are times to reflect. And back in Vietnam, many more religion was more central, and therefore people believed more that there was a God and an afterlife. The interesting thing is an awful lot of the Marines on the battlefield still believe that versus the average person, perhaps. But if you don't have something to hang on to and suddenly the man next to you is killed, it can knock you for a loop a little bit now in a way that it was different in Vietnam.
Yeah, you know, I it's something that has definitely as a soldier and now a naval officer has struck me as well. And I think, you know, kind of haunts our military engagements abroad is both, you know, our response to casualties, our willingness to suffer casualties, and our relationship with, you know, the value of human life, both on our side and on the side of the enemies. And I think this, the last platoon really brings this out, I think, well, when you show, you know, how much one dead Marine means to the Pentagon, that the president is talking about it in a way that would have been impossible in Vietnam, I think. So, you know, what impact do you think has that had on war? Obviously, you know, we know that it brings protest, increases protest, but it also seems like it has this strange counter effect where it brings strategic level actors like the president and the Secretary of Defense down to an almost tactical level, which again, you show in the book where you have the Secretary of Defense almost seems like he's questioning on the ground tactics that should be left. I mean, that probably shouldn't even go much higher than a battalion level, you know, probably in Vietnam, a brigade commander wouldn't have been that concerned about it. So what do you think has happened here? How does that impact ground combat and ground operations?
It's made a vast difference. And that's why in the last platoon, I keep shifting, showing what's happening on the battlefield and then bringing it back to the White House, because I've been to the White House many times. And showing, all of a sudden, they're getting the press reports. They realize, my gosh, we lost another Marine. How did that happen? And the president wanting to control things from the top, I have seen that time after time. And then it gradually gets down the chain of command. Hey, you're not supposed to take casualties. Well, holy cow. I mean, you know, you're out there and all of a sudden you're told, you know, you're not supposed to be taking casualties. And that's where I tried in the book to show the pressure Cruz was under, because his colonel didn't want to take these casualties. He wanted to avoid them. And he was blaming Cruz. And the president then coming down the chain of command, the colonel knew he was in trouble. So I tried to indicate this connectivity that we have, these instant communications, they put a lot of pressure sometimes in an untoward way that shouldn't be there.
Is this effect positive, negative? How do you have any ideas how we might avoid it?
Yes, I do. I mean, I'll tell you. Yeah, I do. The things that I didn't like about Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan is that we didn't fight to win. If you're going to go into a war, it shouldn't just be us that are out there in the platoons that die. You should basically, all the way up and down the chain of command, from the president on down, say, by gosh, we're going to go to war. There's a reason for going to war, and we're going to break the spirit of the enemy so that he does what we want done. And I'm going to put everything I can into doing it. This kind of stuff, like we did in, like President Johnson not wanting to bomb North Vietnam and in Iraq, we got all tangled up. And then in Afghanistan, it was even worse. Trying to say we're going to win the hearts and minds of the people. Well, no, we're not. I mean, the idea that we're going to win the Taliban over or something was crazy. So you asked me a direct question. I'll give you a direct answer. I think that the military at the top, that the generals owe an obligation to be more direct with a president. And when a president says something like, well, we're going to nation build, the generals today went along with him and said, fine, you know, we'll go out and nation build. The general should have said, sir, we have 19 and 20-year-old Marines and soldiers. They have rifles. You only do one thing with a rifle. They don't know how to build a nation. That's a bunch of tribes over there hurtling headlong into the 9th century. If they're going to go out, they're going to go out to fight. And we have to say, these are our objectives on the battlefield. This is what we're going to do. And not get fuzzy-wuzzy the way we did and stay for 20 years without any real notion what we were doing. I'm sorry to kind of explode like that, but, you know, it just, you know.
No, Big, that was great. And, I mean, I don't want to get too political here, but I think it's interesting because it comes to mind that in 2003 there was one general who more or less did that, General Shinseki, and didn't last very long.
Yeah, Shinseki, and he was fired.
Right.
He told the truth, and it drove me crazy in Afghanistan, and everyone. I mean, many Marine generals really don't like the book, The Last Platoon, because they basically say, hey, you know, come on, you know, the colonel wasn't really like that. Oh, yes, he was, you know, and we...
I think the tension between Kaufman and Cruz, between the colonel and the captain, is an excellent one. And, you know, it, I think, highlights some of the bizarre tension. So, I wonder if you could just talk about those two characters and what they represent in the Marine Corps and this whole structure that we're talking about.
Well, one general called me up after he read the book and he said, you know, Bing, he said, we don't have all those kinds of people. And I said, oh, yes, we do, General. I said, you know, there was a great book called The Caine Mutiny. It was written after World War II.
I've only seen the movie. Very good movie.
The chief of naval operations was asked, well, what did you think about that book? And he said, well, at one time or another in my 30 years in the Navy, I've bumped into every son of a bitch that was on that ship, but never all on the same ship at the same time. So there is a little literary license that I took in The Last Platoon, but I tried to indicate the Cruz, he represents the grunt. He represents the guy who's out there on the pointy end, and he's not really, he knew his career was in trouble, and he's trying to balance that against what duty he owes to his men. And at the same time, the colonel, Kaufman, he wants to get promoted, and he feels that Cruz is putting everything in a jeopardy when he shouldn't be doing that. And I try to bring out those tensions because they exist an awful lot. And many times they are not reconciled. And that's why I keep coming back to, at a higher level, before we get into these things like going into Afghanistan and spending 20 years of this stuff, that somebody has to talk to the president and say, Mr. President, I need a direct understanding of how this is going to end.
Yeah, right. Well, and what I think is interesting thinking structurally about the military, you have, I think, in Kaufman and Cruz, the embodiments of two typical kinds of officers with maybe all of the negative traits that one would expect in a staff officer and a line officer. And, you know, maybe are a little bit stereotypes, I think, in a good way, in a functional way between the two. You know, is it possible for one officer to be both parties? It seems in part of the problem is Kaufman is definitely not an enviable figure, but he also seems largely a creature of his own creation. You know, peacetime armies, I often think you have peacetime armies and wartime armies, and they want the opposite things. You know, in the peacetime, you want a military to be fairly risk averse, to make sure that it's ready for war. You don't want people who take a lot of risks. You want people who are good at rules and processes, maybe over outcomes, because that's how you preserve the force. And in war, you want the opposite. You need to take the fleet out and fight it, which, of course, you know, I think always the example of the German battle fleet in World War One. You know, it's a perfect example of a peacetime force in war where it was very pretty. It was very appeared functional on paper, but nobody wanted to commit it in the offing, really. So can we reconcile these two options? Can we have officers that do both, or are we kind of stuck with Kaufman's and Cruz's?
We won't know until the next big war starts. And by that, I mean, we have to be very careful because what has crept in, even to the Army, into the Marines, is this thing called force protection, where we gradually accepted that you were going to go out there and you're going to fight, but nobody was going to die. Well, wow, no, that's not going to happen. And the other thing, Jeff, that I think the Navy, you mentioned the Navy. The Navy has not fought a war engagement against an enemy since 1945. We're 75 years of peace. And in World War II, the Navy ended up relieving an awful lot of ship commanders and submarine commanders very, very quickly because they didn't really turn out to have the right stuff. We're going to get into another big war at some point, and there's going to be a sorting out, and I hope the sorting out can come quickly enough because some people, we have, to a large extent, taken away risk taking. You don't want to have your cruiser run aground, and you don't want somebody just risking lives unnecessarily. So you really won't know until we get into that big war. I think we've become too risk averse, but there's no way you can prove that because you don't want to go to a war just to prove it, you know?
Right, right. Well, I think it's interesting. You know, I think if you read about some of the captain's responses to the collisions with the Fitzgerald and the McCain, I definitely think it sounds like, as well as some other high-profile incidents with ship captains. Now, of course, I'm speaking purely not as a naval officer here, just my own opinion. I think you've seen some naval officers in command positions that maybe didn't have the right stuff, even in peacetime.
We have to be very, very careful, and I don't know quite how to sort it out, but there's one big difference between the Army and the Marines and the Navy in terms of ships, and that is, on a battlefield, as I try to point out in the last platoon, you're maneuvering with 2, 4, 6, 8 people. It was small squads. And you let them go because you can't control them. You don't want to. But any ship the captain fights the ship. The entire ship has to do what one person, that's the captain of the ship, wants to do. There's an entirely different mode there about risk-taking. And there's a great movie with Tom Hanks called Greyhound that's out. It's terrific because when you watch the movie, you see what everything that happened to that destroyer escort. It was what Tom Hanks as the captain decided. So there's a big difference between how the Marines fight decentralized and how any captain has to be centralized.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Bing. And that's actually something as we were talking before, my background as an enlisted man was in the Army. Now I'm an officer in the Navy Reserves. And that's been one of the biggest transitions, I think, between service mentality. I mean, one of the things I think that I never really fully understood about the Navy before I came back in is that difference is that, you know, in the Army, even the Army tends to be more centralized. I think the Marine Corps, it pushes leadership down, or it keeps leadership down at higher levels. The Marine Corps really pushes it down to strategic lance corporal kind of concept. But still, even then, even if you're just a private first class in the Army in an infantry platoon or doing something else, you really have a lot of autonomy. You know, you kind of do, even if it's just your fire, 20 square foot, you know, 25 degree angle fire lane sector in front of you, that is yours, you know, and you make decisions, which is very different. So one of the things that
that's what I tried to Jeff in the book, you know, in the big fight toward the end of the book, it was up to every individual. You know what I mean? You see what I mean? I mean, you know what I'm talking about. I don't want to give the story away, but in the end, it was every single individual Marine.
Right, right, right. Working together as a team to hold everything together, and I think that's kind of what makes the story so compelling beyond, you know, life and death elements, that there is a lot of teamwork. Getting back to the bigger picture, one of the things I have always felt uncomfortable about is in our last wars, the reliance on the CIA. Particularly the paramilitary division of the CIA. Maybe I'm a little old fashioned, but maybe I've read a little too much of the founders, but I am of the mind that armed forces, you know, they're necessary for a nation, but they can be a dangerous thing, particularly when they're not closely supervised. And the CIA, it's hard to supervise what they're doing. So you have the CIA team in the book. I don't want to give too many details away. But could you tell us a little bit about some of the inspirations for the CIA team? And what do you think about this? Is the CIA role in warfare good? It seems like in the book you kind of portray it as a potential to move away from Kaufman types and red tape. What do you think about all this?
I've worked closely with the CIA for many decades. Their special activities group, used to be called the Special Operations Group, in my mind, they're terrific. And I know them very well. I've worked with them. Every one of them comes from a military background to begin with. And they're activists. They're not cowboys. They're highly intelligent. They're in fantastic shape. They're very mature. They know what they're doing, and they do, you're right. They have much less red tape than our services do. So I think any place you go, Jeff, in the Army and the Marines, when they're out on the ground, they welcome these small groups of the agency, the company, when they're out there with them. They really help. They really help.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're very well equipped. I didn't mean, and I that comment, it was not in any way meant to denigrate their professionals. No. Like I said, I just get a little bit nervous when the government, you know, has armed groups that you can't really keep an eye on.
Well, you know, very, very close friends of mine who, you know, are at the top of that and ran it for many years, they turn that on its head and say, no, stop trying to control us from the top. You give us a finding, you tell us what you want to do, and then keep your hands off us and let us do it. So, you know, you can argue both points of view. You can argue both points of view. But I'll tell you, the job they're doing in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and Syria is terrific.
So do you think that they're kind of coming, they're the stopgap for some of the regular uniformed services shortcomings?
No. They're too small for that. No. We're talking very, very small numbers. No. They are very complementary to the special operations forces, and they develop really good intelligence on the ground, but to develop that intelligence takes weeks, sometimes months. So you can't use them as a substitute for having the cruisers of the world, you know, who go out on patrol every day. No, it's more complementary, and that's why I had them in the book. They were there for that special operation in the book. So that's why they were there. They had a special operation, and they just happened to work with Cruz in the book because, you know, they both wanted to stay alive.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's interesting, too. You know, I think this is another thing that I personally also get a little concerned about is, you know, the relationship between some of these organizations like the CIA, Special Activities Division, and Special Forces and the infantry. I think sometimes, unfortunately, in the military, but also in the popular imagination, people put them as a hierarchy, you know, like you're in the infantry and the infantry is not as good as maybe the Green Berets, and the Green Berets aren't as good as the SEALs. And no one's as good as the CIA. But really, there's a much more complementary relationship. Is that correct?
Oh, sure. Everybody. But some of these guys are awful gosh darn good, especially the Delta guys. But everyone, yeah. But no one objects when somebody who is, say you're, you know, like in the book, I tried to indicate the squad leaders kind of held them in awe when they're out on patrol with them, as well they should, because the average age of the CIA guys I had in the book was 37 to 40. And the average, you know, squad leader was 24. Of course, he's going to look up to them to a certain extent, and he should. But they work it out. There aren't any big difficulties there. They work that out.
And so, obviously, the Taliban plays a major role in this book. How did you write about the Taliban? What sources did you draw from?
Oh, I was over there many times, and a lot of the military is very nice to me. I was allowed into the prisons. I had a chance to talk to the Taliban who had been captured. I had a chance to talk to ISIS who had been captured. And then we have really good intel people. And then they get on the radio, as I indicate in the book, and they're willing to chat with you and argue with you and everything else. I mean, it's a bizarre situation. You know, they're all on their ICOMs. They're all on their everyone has a cell phone over there, by the way. So there's no mystery to them. And I tried to indicate that the Taliban, on the one hand, are some of them religious, like the emir that I painted. You know, he lives in Pakistan. But at the same time, all of them are part of the drug trade, and the drugs. When we're talking over $500 million straight cash pouring out of the bottom of Afghanistan every year, going into Pakistan, and then being converted into heroin, then going into Iran, and through Iran it goes up into the Balkans, Serbia, etc., and then it goes into Russia and Western Europe. So everyone is dirty. Everyone knows that they are poisoning someone by doing this. And I tried to indicate that. Even the farmers who are out there, you know, making, they know that what they're doing is wrong, but they're doing it. And don't say, they're not poor. They are not. They can grow anything there. But the poppy pays twice as much as anything. So I tried to indicate, yes, there's the religious strain to the Taliban, absolutely. But there's also that element, we're all going to get our share out of the poppy.
Right. It seems like sometimes there was a big question in the book about what the real fight was. Again, I don't want to give anything away, but, you know, the main target of the main mission was not maybe necessarily what people might think it was, especially if you come from a background where you think about HVI, high value individual targeting, and whatnot. And so I think that was very interesting. What do you think the role there is with the drug fighting in Afghanistan, also Iraq and Syria to a lesser degree? Do you think that that is rightfully the kind of a big focus, or do you think we should be focusing on other things?
I'd make a huge distinction. It's nothing in Iraq or Syria. So that's a separate subject entirely. In Afghanistan, it permeates the entire society. Should we get out of Afghanistan? I think we should get down to about 1,000 people, some of our CIA guys, some of our special operators, and especially, you know, some of our pilots and drones, and just keep pressure on the Taliban. But don't think that we can ever get back. Like, I put this platoon into the province of Helmand down in the south. Don't think we can ever get Helmand back. It's gone. The areas that are heavy and poppy are controlled by the Taliban. And since the farmers are getting money from the heroin, from the poppy, why in goodness gracious, for what reason would they want a government coming in and saying, you can't do that anymore? And there are a lot of people on the government side too that are getting their shares. In fact, the whole thing is the government gets about 7%, the Taliban gets about 15%, and the other 75%, you know, the higher up take about 50%, and the farmers get maybe 25%. The whole thing is divided up. I mean, it's, you know, so the idea that we're going to clean that up in Afghanistan, no, we're not. The only thing, I don't think we should lose Kabul, because I was the special assistant to Secretary of Defense Schlesinger in 1975 when Saigon fell. And the mood in America when we began to realize, holy cow, it was really, really bad. And I don't want to see us go through that. So I would keep some troops there so that the Taliban cannot take Kabul. But I would not have any illusions that we can go down into Helmand or something and take it back.
Yeah. So, and that raises an interesting question: the role of the government in your novel. The government is pretty absent. There's an Afghan National Army patrol. I think it was, I don't know whether it was Afghan National Army or Afghan National Police. Sometimes they're difficult to tell apart,
right?
Other than the uniforms they wear in terms of their operational posture. But what is the role of the government? Is it basically non-existent? What do these ANA patrols really do?
Try to stay alive and not be there. I put this patrol there. In reality, let me put it this way. Year after year when I went over there, and this is one of the reasons I finally decided to write this novel and get it off my chest. When I went out with the Marines, they always had some Afghan soldiers with them, and we could clear an area. But I met no Marine captain, I met no Marine lieutenant or sergeant who ever believed that once we left, those Afghan soldiers would stay out in the area we call the Green Zone, because it was very vegetated and you'd bump into the Taliban at very short range, let alone stay out in the poppy fields. And sure enough, as soon as we pulled out, they stopped patrolling. Well, there is no draft in Afghanistan. Most of the Afghan army fighting in the south, and now they're only in a couple of cities hanging on for dear life. They come from the Tajik tribe from the north. They don't even speak the language down there. So a lot of what we were doing for many years didn't make sense. And I tried to illustrate that in the book, that without us being there, they wouldn't be there.
Yeah, and one of the only real contacts between the Marines and the Afghan forces is a Green Beret captain. What is that interface like? Is that usually how tenuous the connection between the two groups is? And is that an effective coordination method in your experience?
Again, every character in the book is a real character. And the Green Beret character, he's really quite a character. But the answer is yes. The ODA teams, the Special Forces teams, they linked up with a lot of the Afghan national, and they were their advisors. The group that gets along best, as you can imagine, was our Special Operations Forces in our CIA units that had intergrouped to them the very best of the Afghan soldiers with them. But they were very small units. When you get down to where we were in Helmand that I was describing, you would have an advisory unit, the Green Berets in this particular case. We used the Green Berets a lot down there. And they would just have a very small unit. And then they really liked having the Marines around. So we all got along very well.
And so one of the other things that struck me reading it, and maybe again, this is thinking about, you know, military policy and structure on a somewhat higher level than the ground combat that you really focused on in the book. How do all these pieces link? And that is a theme. You have the CIA team come in and they maybe are complementary to Kaufman's mission, maybe not complementary to Kaufman's mission. He has spent some time figuring them out. Ultimately, I think because of his personality, it seems like he doesn't make the use of them that he could have. But, you know, also you have the Green Berets with the Afghans. Kaufman has a hard time integrating those into his unit. Cruz comes in as an individual augmentee from the United States. That's a lot of moving pieces. You know, is this pretty typical from your experience over there? And how does one get all of this stuff to integrate?
Well, I'll say two different things. The first is historically, for the last 10 years, the way you integrate everything is very simple. You have perfect communications, better communications than you and I do now, Jeff. Everyone has video that they're talking with higher headquarters and looking them in the eye. And then every night, especially the poor Army platoons, had to turn in PowerPoints of where they were going to go on their patrols. And this gets up to division headquarters. And then then they have what they call, a battlefield update assessment. And you will walk into an auditorium, and there will the general be at the back. and before him, there'll be maybe 100, you know, soldiers and et cetera, all on their computers. And then somebody gets up on stage and he briefs the weather, and the next person briefs intelligence, the next person briefs operations. And then above them, there's another group, and they go back to Tampa, Florida. And then Tampa, Florida goes to the headquarters in the Joint Staff in Washington, D.C. Then the Washington, D.C. staff, they go to the Secretary of Defense, then the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense go over to the White House, and then they get together with the National Security Council, and all of them have perfect communications.
And I assume all talking about the patrol that's going on tomorrow or something similar to that.
That's why I indicated in this particular case. I mean, it's getting all the way up to the top. The poor Cruz just lost another guy, you know. The answer is yes, for the last 20 years, because our communications has been exquisite, too exquisite. It's like you have, you're in a large Coliseum and you have a football game going on, but Jerry Jones of the Dallas Cowboys is up in his booth talking with, you know, the Secretary of Defense or something. Oh, let's send in a play. You see what I mean? And get down to the coach, you know, and the coach says to the quarterback, hey, we got a new play coming in play. You got what? You know, but But the great danger is, I don't believe those communications are going to be there when we get into a tough war. I think those communications are going to, I don't think they're going to be there. Yeah. And we then are going to have to adapt and decentralize like that.
Well, and I know at least on the Navy side, there's been a lot of emphasis now on running, running maneuvers and field exercises, you know, fleet exercises or something. I'm going to use my Navy terminology, in, you know, denied environments is I think what they usually call it. But, you know, I think it's interesting, though. I wonder if we were talking about the relatively low level of actual fighting that happens in Iraq and Afghanistan a little earlier in the conversation. And I wonder if that's a side effect, you know, if we had, even if we did have that perfect communications, and we were, say, having even Vietnam levels of combat, you know, you couldn't report everything, you know? I think the fact that we have so few patrols is seems to me partly what enables some of that perfect communication.
Well, I was just thinking of the other aspect, you know, in a company in a day in Vietnam, you take 5 KIA in a fight. Some of the battalions, you take 60 killed in a day or 2 days up along the Trace Cantien and places. Gee, we'd have sometimes 100 killed in a day. And I don't know how the press, I don't know how the White House, I don't know how, Jeff, I don't know how our society would think in terms of those casualties that are bound to happen in another big war, because we've become so used to really losing very, very few people. And the other thing, and I know now this is getting far afield, but the other thing, the entire world in a way, I mean, this COVID still flabbergasts me that the entire world shut down in ways that I thought were quite extraordinary. You know, I just have this. My next book is going to be about this, by the way. My next novel, I'm going to get into what's another big war going to look like, and how's our society going to handle it. I think we have to be very careful that we, you can't fight and not lose people.
Well, I agree. I think it's an interesting, I mean, I don't want to get too far afield on the COVID thing. I think our thinking on that issue may be the same, but keeping it more restricted to this, I agree. And I wonder sometimes, even if would be unwilling to even initiate wars that we may have to otherwise, because of that concern for casualties. I think our understanding of human life, I think, as you indicated early, part of it's religious. I think part of it's other things going on is changed in some very substantial ways. And I think it's had interesting impacts on combat. You don't cover some of the requirements for humanitarian assistance as much in this book, but you know, there's a lot of concern for non-combatants. You do talk about a little bit. You talk about a little bit of a shift where one of the younger boys might have gotten a little better attention in the beginning. Yep. Well, why don't you talk about that? How has that changed our view of casualties, particularly the casualties of the enemy and civilians over the course of this war?
Well, the enemy, with the aid of the villagers, does a very good job of policing the battlefield and taking away their casualties. We, relative to the civilians, I believe we went to extraordinary lengths to help. I mean, wherever we could, but it became, it's really tough when your generals on down are telling you, don't really fire if you don't have to fire when you're getting fire from a compound because there might be civilians inside. That's, again, it gets all the way back to you have to define your purpose and you have to determine what you mean by going to war before, and not be trying to work it out every day on the battlefield. And in the last platoon, I put crews in a couple of situations there where some of the poor civilians and the kids, really badly hurt, and he has to make the decision on the spot. What's he going to do about this? So just to drive it home so that people realize it's what you look at every day when you're out there on that battlefield. It's what you look at.
Yeah, I think you did an effective job forcing some of those choices. And, you know, I think it's hard for many people, and maybe this gets back to the purpose of this kind of fiction, to imagine that because we face so many fewer life or death situations as civilians. You know, if you go back and read stories, I remember my wife and I were listening to The Last of the Doughboys on an audio tape. And I think, you know, it was an interview with the last surviving World War I soldiers. It was done sometime in the early 2000s. And they were talking about death in their lives. And they mentioned that, you know, growing up, I had four brothers and two of them were killed in farm accidents.
Right.
You know, that I think just, I mean, that changes it because you, when you go to war, then you have a kind of a conception and a rhetoric and an understanding of that to draw from.
That's correct. And some of the places, I was in Sangin, which was the hottest place hit. And therefore it really is the location for the book, The Last Platoon. And I did put in the novel what I actually saw. When we were going out every day, we would bump into three or four or five improvised explosive devices. And we all went single file behind the engineer with the, doing the mine detection sweeping. But it's you're going to lose people.
And yeah, which, by the way, I don't mean to interrupt you, Bing, but reading that every time I read about that and I thought about my brother was also a combat engineer in the Army. That's got to be a brave fellow.
Well, but, you know, I tried to drive it home by indicating, and this actually happened when I was out there with them, that one of the squad leaders put two tourniquets on his legs before he left the base. And he said, and so I did it in the novel, too, you know, and Cruz said to him, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, sir, if I get blown up, I'm going to cinch myself up. I don't want anyone taking a chance of trying to come to me." And Cruz said, "You're a hard case." But he said, you're really going to frighten everyone else in the unit. So take off those damn tourniquets. But the tourniquet, well, I don't want to get into it, but compared to Vietnam, the tourniquet was so much different, so much more terrific. But still, you know, that's like asking guys, I'll stop it right there. But you have to expect you're going to be seeing an awful lot of blood and gore. And so I tried in the book not to shy away from letting people know what happens when you're out there.
Yeah, well, I think you did an excellent job, and we're getting about to the end of the hour now, Bing. So I know you mentioned something about a book that you were thinking about writing a little bit ago. So I wonder if you could bring us out by telling us what plans you have in store.
Well, I found out something about writing in this book, and that is that it's hard now to get reviews of books about combat. The average literary reviewer isn't wild about the subject matter, but
and you're not in the standard MFA subject category, unless you're writing something very narrow kind of thing.
Yeah, if I had the hairy chested woodpecker or something, I could do better. But you know, what I'm really tempted to do, I think it probably take me a couple of years, but you know what I'd like to do? And I already have in mind. Take a battle from World War II, and I have the one in mind, and then how that played out and how the American public reacted, and then use that exact scenario, which only this time, and one time it was against the Japanese, the next time it would be against the Chinese, and then try to see whether society would respond the way we did in World War II.
Yeah, so a little bit of a sociological thought experiment.
So to speak.
Well, I am an anthropologist by training, so I guess that kind of thing is interesting to me as well. Well, Bing, that sounds great, and when you write it, if you write it, I hope we can have you back.
Well, thanks, Jeff. By the way, did you like this book?
I did. I thought it was great. I thought it accomplished what you wanted to, and I have a better appreciation for it now. So I don't want to I don't want to inflate your ego, Bing. It's you've already accomplished enough. I don't think I could do that anyway, but it was a good book.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay, thank you. Semper Fidelis. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. West, for being a guest on the show, and thank you for listening to New Books in Military History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.